Hey, Richard Gottlieb.
Rick Burns.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. We got a guest from Sweden today. We've never had a guest from Sweden before.
Continuing our parade of international guests with fascinating things to talk to us about, this is the Playground Podcast with me, Chris Byrne, my co-host and cohort, Richard Gottlieb. We are brought to you by Global Toy Experts, The Toy Guy, and Beacon Media Group. And today, we're going to talk about an amazing site and coming toy line called Star Stable. And we are really pleased to welcome Johan Schoberg, who is the CEO of Star Stable Entertainment. And Johan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's a pleasure to be able to get the opportunity to talk to you a little bit about what we've been doing for the last decade or so.
This is what we always say. It takes 10 years to make an overnight sensation. So tell us a little bit about Star Stable, its genesis, and who it's for, and what it is.
About 15 years ago, we were a small group in Sweden that were approached by a Norwegian book club who had a massive problem with churn because the kids weren't reading books. So we came up with the idea of, why don't you give your readers video games for free? They might stick around. Given that this was a book club focused on horses, we thought that it might be good if the video games were about horses. And given that most video games about horses at that time were centered around the everyday life in the stables, we thought that it might be interesting to mix it up a bit with the backgrounds that we had. And instead of sticking to the mundane realism of stable chores, to fuse the horse fantasy with magic. And we came up with a concept which was essentially what would happen if you married Black Beauty with Harry Potter. And wow, a series called Starshine Legacy was born that was later turned into Star Stable as we moved on.
I'm curious as to how you married the book experience with the interactive, your line says it's a horse game full of adventures. How did you marry those two experiences for kids?
Originally, what we did, the book club had, they published numerous books about horses, and we created a brand new brand and IP story world and fantasy universe to cater to that audience that was completely separate from anything that they had, with the one common denominator naturally being the horses. The interesting thing is that then as we continued to develop that brand over time, and it eventually turned into our current flagship product, which is called Star Stable Online, which we'll talk about later, we've then gone full circle and turned the video games into books. So we have a very successful line of, should we say, urban fantasy books centered around the horses and the magic based on the story world created for the video games that were created to handle anti-churn in a book club about horses.
What is the targeted age grade for the video games, and can you tell us a little bit about the market for horse-based play, which is large, I believe, is primarily female?
If we start at the beginning, like what we set out to do when we went about creating the games, we'd seen a lot of products being made for girls in the game space, and we felt that they weren't taking the audience seriously in the sense of treating the subject matters that they really cared about, in this case horses, with the respect that it deserved. Neither were the games real games, if you will, but rather quite potentially shallow experiences with slightly lower production values. So we felt like, what would happen if we'd make real games for girls? And our creative director at the time was obsessed with a little game called World of Warcraft. And we'd been making these original adventure games with the magic world and the horses. And he was like, right, what's the next step for us? And we looked around at the studio and was like, why don't we just make World of Warcraft, but with horses in this universe? How hard could that possibly be? And naturally, it was quite hard, but it was doable. And it was also then as soon as the product hit the market, it was immediately recognizable that there was an audience there that was primarily tween and teen girls that had a high horse affinity interest, but also were gamers. And they got the unique opportunity to engage with their favorite subject matters, the things that they really cared about and loved, in an environment where they were also, at least to a significant degree, insulated. We're with the girls, and we normally say that they come for the horses because that's their common interest. They stick around for the story and the characters and the magical world. But what really makes them a true part of our community is the social ties that they form with the other players on the platform.
I do want to talk about the community you've built in a moment, but I also want to go back to when you launched this 10 years ago. There was a preconception that girls were not gamers, and we know that that's not true, but nobody was making products that really embraced that. What convinced you that girls would want to be gamers, and that, you know, all horses aside, that the mechanics of the game and the adventure and the World of Warcraft with horses would be appealing?
We had the unique opportunity, naturally, to test our ideas with the community of the book club. So, like, the original concept had been proven. When we realized that there would be an audience was probably when we released the second set of offline video games, which was called Star Stable the Season Rider. It was four games covering spring, summer, autumn, and winter. And all of a sudden, YouTube started to be flooded with fan-made videos where they'd edited together the best footage from their free riding in this magical world, together with some of their favorite soundtracks. And literally hundreds of thousands of these videos started to materialize online. And we realized then that there is an audience out here, and the promise of having that freedom of exploring a large world was something that players wanted. And then as we added the MMO component, if you will, or World of Warcraftified it, that's when it really took off, because then the community finally had an opportunity to interact with each other in real time, in game, rather than just through the commentator fields on YouTube, for instance.
It's amazing to me that YouTube became such a platform for expression. A couple of weeks ago, we talked to Chun Ng, who created the Rainbow Loom, and people sharing their creations on YouTube was one of the ways that the community was built. So it's really fascinating. But you have taken that a step further. You have apps, you have other ways to engage people. How important is that community to you, especially in terms of launching new product and getting the word out and keeping people enrolled in the property?
For us, like, our community is everything. We would be absolutely nothing without the community. And it's such an important way to make sure that we stay in touch and stay true to the reason that we got this started in the first place, right? Because we need to keep that continuous dialogue with the community to make sure that we're holding ourselves true to the promise that we originally made, which was about making real games for girls, and making sure that we're listening to them, taking their feedback seriously, and integrating it into the product as much as possible. And we've taken a lot of steps quite recently in opening up a lot more with our dialogue with the community about what's going on behind the scenes. Because as you might know, it's like, making video games is not a highly predictable business. It's a, should we say, adventure fraught with peril, pitfalls, the occasional dragon in a den that will breathe fire on you and your party will perish and things like that, which means that things don't necessarily turn out as you expect them to. We've made the decision quite recently that we still want to talk to our community a lot more about what we're doing, what we're thinking, and what's coming next, so that they can be more involved with providing feedback.
the star is stable girl. She's a tween. She's confronting puberty, issues of socialization, sexuality, and things today that we never even dreamed of when we were children. So it's a very complicated world. Do your storylines reflect any of the world that they engage with every day?
Yes, absolutely. So I think that for us, our storylines center around a couple of very common main themes, right? They center around friendship, love in the broader sense. We're not that focused on romantic love, but the love between people, animals, individuals, and the larger community. We tackle the everyday challenges that comes with the tensions of friendship and the challenges that that sometimes bring, as well as the constant threat of external evils or threats in regards to things like the environment, big corp, and other elements. And we also celebrate things like diversity, equality, inclusion, and we also tackle the challenges of coming, for instance, from a broken home, being raised by a single parent, those types of themes, as well as many, many others. In our stories and adventures, we balance the fantastic with the mundane and the relevant so that our audience can recognize themselves, their friends, families, and the challenges and the conflicts that they see.
Let's talk a little bit about the business side of it. How do you make money? What is the revenue model? How does that work?
We have a pretty straightforward model. Our Star Stable Online is a free-to-try game in the sense that you play the first five levels, which are limited to both a geographical area of the game map as well as progression in the story, and that's all playable for free. Then if you become a star rider, which is the equivalent of being a subscriber to our service, you can either pay that on an ongoing basis or pay once for a perpetual membership. Then you get access to the entire world, all of the story, and you can play forever. On top of that, we have in-app purchases that are tied to an in-game currency called Star Coins that is used for premium items in the game, such as horses. But we also have a soft currency that can be earned in the game called Jorvik Shilling that you earn through, for instance, completing quests, either by completing the story or doing slightly more mundane things like mucking out the stables. And you can use that to buy other types of resources like gear for your horse or similar things.
I wanted to talk a little bit about branding because you started as a alternative to a book club to get people to buy books. And now you've established this and you're creating books out of that. So it's a very different way people engage with IP and then they want the additional products. I know you're going into the toy business. What prompted that?
For a long time, we've been looking at great ways for us to extend the brand, but also continuously to find a better way to keep our audience engaged and being able to have a physical presence, if you will, in our players' lives, right? It's like Star Stable Online is a digital world. It exists on your desktop, it exists on your laptop, it exists in your cell phone if you're currently an iOS device holder. But having that additional physical presence is a big deal for us. And I've always been a big toy person myself. Like, it's the tangible awesomeness of seeing the characters that you've created and that you've lived with so long being materialized with a physical, tangible presence is extremely powerful. And I take it all the way back from, like, when I was 6 years old and I got my first Star Wars toy sent from my dad, who was currently doing his postdoc in the UK. I got my first Star Wars, which was the Hammerhead character. I had absolutely no idea what this was, but it was just amazing. And ever since that, like, I've been a huge fan of lots of toy lines, including everything up to the extremely detailed McFarlane toys that broke through in the 90s and completely like reshaped what collectibles could be and action figures. And so to me, having that, being able to put our characters in the hands of our players and fans, but also perhaps having the opportunity to find new players that are amazed by how cool our lead characters are and have them be picked up and go, wow, I want to experience more of this. How do I engage with this further? So that's what's prompted it.
So do you see this as a collectible line aimed at tweens and maybe adults, or do you see this as a toy and graded a little younger?
No, so this is primarily intended to be a collectible range, but naturally it should be able to inspire the younger audience as well to pick it up and play with it because it's so amazing.
This is no small undertaking. You mentioned that there were pitfalls and even some dragons in the process of getting to where you are today. What would you like people in the toy and video game industries to know about this process and these strategies as they considered other platforms to expand their IP?
What it comes down to first is audience fit with your existing audience. So to me, the key component of brand extensions or moving your brand into other platforms is all about whether the products that you're creating are relevant for your existing audience. Are you serving your fans? You need to create products that are true to the brand, products that will be appreciated, cherished, and embraced by the existing fans so that they can be your advocates and missionaries as you try to reach a broader audience. And make sure that you're focusing on types of products that strongly align with the brand values and brand strengths that you have. When we decided to go back into books, because we wanted to deepen the relationship between our community and our fans and the inner lives of the characters that we have in our game. An MMORPG is great for many things, but it's not the best place to tell a deep story about personal development, for instance, and the challenges that you go through as a tween or teen. And we wanted to make sure that our audience got the opportunity to see that side of our characters. And therefore, we felt, all right, books, that makes sense, because that gives our audience access to the inner lives of our characters in a much better and more direct way.
It goes back to something that I keep saying, which is narrative is the way in which your customer or your player or the child takes that narrative into his or her own life. Is really what determines the power of a property.
Absolutely. I wholeheartedly agree. Having that strong narrative and those strong characters is also what then forms the rules for play in that universe. And the rules for play in a universe is super central to what products you decide to expand into, because you want to, again, stay true to those and make sure that they are aligned with the products that you're creating.
Now, you are a Swedish company. You created a product that is a global product. So when you deal across cultures, do you find that there is a commonality around horses with girls? Is that fairly universal? And do you find that your storylines speak across culture pretty easily, or do you have to be very careful to make sure that you are telling a global story?
The interest for horses varies greatly across cultures, which means that our stories are, at least in our experience so far, going to resonate most strongly in the geographies where there's also a strong horse affinity among our age audience. We're seeing that across the world, and we can actually quite easily correlate how well we're doing in a given market with how interested the population is with horses in general. So that's one thing that we do see. When it comes to other themes, so it's like how you tackle certain themes of coming of age, etc., we naturally need to be careful that we're striking the right balance in telling those stories with enough edge that we're relevant, but also that we're not alienating people with being perhaps too aggressive on some fronts. However, we also make the choices of staying out of markets where their opinions on certain matters might make it difficult for us to tell the stories that we want to tell. So that's a conscious balance that we make. Star Stable Online is available in about 180 countries in the world where it's played. We're available in 14 languages. We've got global presence in that sense.
Apps are really important in your development. You're currently available only on iOS. Are you going to Android?
As we look to the future, we want to be available where our players play. And for the first 10 years of our existence, we were a desktop, laptop product only. In February this year, we launched globally on iOS, of which I'm extremely proud. Not all our players have iPhones or iPads. So we are fully in full throttle or full gallop ahead to bring the game to Android as well for full cross-platform play seamlessly, just as on iOS. I'm not going to promise any dates, but we are very hard at work.
Okay, Johan, we're going to ask you the question that we ask everybody on season 4 of the Playground Podcast. What was your favorite play experience as a child?
I'm going to have to go Star Wars. I'm really sorry about that. But it's the one that's like, the delivery of the mystical hammerhead action figure really sunk its claws into me for a very long period of time. And I was truly committed to that property for such a long time. I've just handed down my Ewok village to my 7-year-old son. He doesn't quite get how awesome it is, but he still thinks that the bears are cute.
I'm glad to hear that, because you kind of hinted at that before, that the power of that one toy to really inspire you. And I think that's wonderful. Johan Schoberg, CEO of Star Stable Entertainment. This has been really great to talk to you. I've spent some time on the site. The animation is amazing. The options are amazing. The stories are great. And thank you for spending the time with us today. This is the Playground Podcast, and we'll be right back with the end cap. And now we come to the part of the show that we call the end cap, where Richard and I discuss issues that have relation to the toy industry and entertainment. And today, Richard, you're going to get a little animated.
I am, my clever friend. We're going to talk about animated characters today, some of the great ones and what makes them great. Chris, I wrote an article that asked the question, what are the great animated characters and what makes them so? And one of the things I pointed out in the article was that they have an element of humanity. No matter what they are, whether they're a mouse or a robot, they are human in their emotions. And they are therefore relatable to children. And the more universal the emotions are, the more, I think, relevant they become to a broader swath of humanity.
And it's classic child development that a child has through fiction, whether it's literature or animation, they have the vicarious experience of overcoming an obstacle. And so that when they come to that obstacle in real life, they are actually prepared for it. They have developed the cognitive ability and even the physical synapses for dealing with something. So you need all of those human elements. You need power and conflict. You need a good guy and a bad guy. And whether that bad guy is the coyote, who's a very silly coyote in the Roadrunner cartoons, or Mayor Humdinger in Paw Patrol. It's the same character. It is the person against whom the child measures his or her moral compass, developing moral compass.
And as we have learned, these characters are generational. For you and me, they were the wonderful Looney Tunes cartoons that were peopled, I'll use that word, with Bugs Bunny and Sylvester and Daffy, and they made us laugh, and they still make us laugh. And there is something so humanly relatable to Sylvester the cat, who, when confronted with a baby kangaroo who is who he believes is a giant mouse, and he is humiliated in front of his son because he cannot defeat this giant mouse. That is relatable as a child, and it's relatable as to any adult the first time they have lost to their child in some kind of a game.
Right. And, you know, and that abstract concept and the humanity is so important because we love to laugh at that. It's the same as classical theater. It's the same as anything. We relate to the characters. And I think this is an important topic right now because of the proliferation of animated characters and what makes one enduring. Why does a Paw Patrol stick around? Well, Paw Patrol is really at its base about helping. It's really that the humans, the grown-up humans, need assistance from the Paw Patrol. The children relate to the Paw Patrol, and it's very empowering for them to feel like they are with Rubble and Skye and Chase, and they are the ones who can come in and help save the day. And that vicarious experience can be very empowering as a child is developing.
Yeah, you make a very good point that there's a lot of overcoming these characters. Take Bugs Bunny. He is confronted with Elmer Fudd, who is pretty funny, but he's carrying a gun. His open and avowed intent is to kill Bugs Bunny. And yet Bugs Bunny, by being smarter and wilier, manages every time to defeat Elmer Fudd. And he does it, whether it's Elmer Fudd or Yosemite Sam, who goes off the diving board multiple times in the Fearless Freak cartoon. And these things, I think, are wonderfully empowering, that you can overcome somebody bigger, meaner, tougher than you are.
And I think that's one of the premises of children's literature. You look at The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, you look at Harry Potter, you look at many of these classics of children's literature, and what do they do in the first part? They get the parents out of the way. And then the child has to figure out his or her way through it. Ursula Le Guin does it in other things. It's classic quest literature in animation form.
You know, I'm also wondering, a lot of young people may have never heard of the Heckle and Jekyll cartoon. About two very anarchistic crows.
Right.
And there have been Woody Woodpecker in the original incarnation was an anarchist. Bugs Bunny was pretty wild early on. I'm not sure children are comfortable with that much anarchy. They're more comfortable with a little more civilized.
These characters in these stories also represent bringing order out of chaos, which is another trope of all of these stories and all of this literature, and very relatable to children as they're being socialized into a culture. When you look at Bugs Bunny, that was not originally intended for children. So many of the cultural references, I still remember, you know, the rabbit in red, the boys are crazy for the rabbit in red. You know, I didn't know what that was when I was a child. It was silly. Or my brothers and my favorite one is What's Opera, Doc?, where that was the first exposure to Wagner many of us had.
Well, that is a really dark cartoon. Elmer Fudd does kill the rabbit. He says, kill the world.
Right.
The world. And, these are wonderful. And I think that children who grow up today, I hope they'll look back on Skye and Dora and have the warm, fuzzy and funny memories we have.
And it does really underscore, as we were talking about with Johan in the front part of this episode, it really does underscore the importance of narrative, both as didactic and entertainment for all of us and culturally relevant. And that's really what animated characters do. There's more to come from this, obviously. And this is the Playground Podcast with me, Chris Byrne, my co-host and cohort, Richard Gottlieb. We are brought to you by Global Toy Experts, The Toy Guy, and Beacon Media Group. And thanks for listening. And
hopefully, that's all, folks.
I couldn't have said it better.
Da 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 da